Hello, and welcome to another edition of Wordplay. I'm Sebastian Matthews, along with Jeff Davis, and today our guests are Gary Hawkins and Landon Godfrey. Right back.
They sat together in the park as the evening sky grew dark. She looked at him and he felt a spark tingle to his bones. It was there and he felt alone and wished that he got straight and watched out for a simple twist of fate. They walked along by the old canal, a little confused, I remember it well. Stopped into an old hotel with the neon burning bright. He felt the heat of the night hit him like a freight train moving with a simple twist of fate. A clarinet someplace softly played. She was walking on by the arcade. She heard the melody rise and fade. The sign was coming up. She dropped a coin into the cup of a blind man at the gate and forgot about a simple twist of fate. He woke up and she was gone. He didn't see nothing but the dawn. He got out of bed, put his clothes back on, pushed back the blind, found a note she'd left behind, to which he just could not relate all about a simple twist of fate.
A beautiful version of a beautiful song. Well, Gary and Landon, so nice to have you here. Let's begin with some poems, one from each.
Excellent. Sure.
Gary?
I'll start.
I can start.
I'm happy to hear that the FBI is looking for D.B. Cooper again, yeah. So I can make some, helps me out with this poem. It's called Self-Portrait as D.B. Cooper. Self-Portrait as D.B. Cooper. Once in the windowless lounge of the Spar with a girl I was after, I rose, gathering my sentences and my mouth full of gin, and as I passed by her chair on my way to the men's, gave her head a breathy kiss, which she met with the longing and terror of a hostage, while I moved on down the dirty hall to the back of the house, and there put my hand instead on the service door, swollen a bit with urine or with tears or, hell, just with the dirty rain that clattered down the downspouts and dropped into the bottomless alley into which I stepped, that foul pitch back of bars and which, like a forest, subsumed me.
Nice.
That's beautiful. Since Gary's starting with a self-portrait, I think I will do the same. So this is called Self-Portrait. Landon, in the middle of a field, Wheaton galaxy laid out flat, clarifying something infinite. Landon, skyward in the landscape, which yellows, greens, duns, golds, brights, like the pointillism of bird scratches on the gamboge surface of a desert planet. Light cross-hatching the shadows until everything shimmers, like solved quadratic equations reflecting silvery chalk dust, like bee wings honeying, glint. She can't sleep forever. Soon the manifestations of reason will disarrange this unsorrowed unknown back into little patterned certainties. Even cellophane opaques completely when folded enough on itself. But pity the word gamboge. It can't survive long outside of a dream.
Nice. Two self-portraits. Good way to begin. I see Jeff. He's going to come on in. Come on in, Jeff. He's coming. As you may know, having listened to the show before, Gary Hawkins is the director of the Creative Writing Department at Warren Wilson. Landon Godfrey also teaches at Warren Wilson. They're married. And,
yes.
quite an artistic team. I thought we could start by me asking you just talk a little bit about that blog you do with the photographs. Is that's a nice way to look at the collaboration. It's just one part of it that you guys share.
Yeah, well, I guess it's not that new. We've been doing it for about half a year now. Yeah, Lannan's Innovation turned us onto a blog called 3191, where the two women who live 3,191 miles apart take one photo every morning and don't consult about it, and then post it on a blog. And so that's our mode. We take a picture a day, don't consult about it. I send it off to Landon. She does some sort of magical Photoshop stitching together and put them together. But anyway,
it's a wonderful project because we two poet family, pretty verbal, constant conversation.
Yeah. As my father has famously said, you can't just talk about the weather at our house.
So this is nice. There's no talking about this. And sometimes, actually, the photographs talk to each other, and sometimes they don't. And sometimes they're really beautifully
in sync. I check in on it every now and then. And even when they don't, they will across horizontally sometimes. You know, you keep going around, keep going forward, and one will chime off another one. But when they work together, it's the metaphor at its...
Yeah, it's perfect. There's one, my favorite one is my photograph was a picture of a dead crow's feet, and Gary's photograph was a picture of a sign that said, "Do not enter, no trespassing." And I'm not sure why they worked so well together, except that they were both extremely sad and very wintry pictures.
Awesome. Well, Jeff, how you doing, man?
Oh, okay, Sebastian. Yeah. How about you?
I'm doing well.
Yeah.
Good. There's tea out there, you know.
I noticed there's a whole tea set going on.
Why not? Yeah. You know,
that's different. A nice innovation.
Yeah. Yes. You're listening to WNCW, Progressive Voice of the Mountains. This is Wordplay.
WPVM.
WNCW. God, shoot me with a stick. Or stick me with a shot. Or bang me with a tiss. Well, I was listening to it on the way here.
God. Wow, is that your fantasy to be a DJ?
I guess so.
Next year.
I'm just moving past this little joint. WPVM 103.5. Progressive voice of the mountains. This is going to be cut out too. I'm not.
Welcome to This American Life. Oh, yeah.
I'm Ira Glass.
I'm Ira Glass. Today we're going to talk about beautiful childhood where nothing ever went wrong. Yeah.
Mercury must be retrograde. You
know. Yeah, I think so.
Who knows?
How about another poem? I'm out of here.
Great.
I'm gone.
Sure. Yeah, great.
Our furnace has been out for the last 5 months. 5 months, 5 weeks, not 5 months. So we just got it back, and we are back in the modern world.
Good timing.
Yeah, the luxurious world. So I was picking poems, and I found that there was this theme of luxury coming in. So this is a short little poem called Mies van der Rohe Daybed. Sprawled like a long shadow against morning's upright regime, I compose symphonies sewn like upholstery to line the empty room and tuck out the light. I have given up my books, all out of season fruits and flowers, reposing thought as in a monastery or any land of broad, dark, leisurely pursuits.
This is called Still Life with Red Silk Shoes and Perfume. I spent my money on red silk shoes and champagne, water in pink labeled bottles from France, mustards and kippers from anywhere but home. Every night I dreamt about being unfaithful with my teachers or rabbis or actors, and would have slept with more people had there been time. I loved so much. So many objects seemed alive. So many bodies accompanied mine to restaurants and museums to look at other bodies and things. A bounty of adornment to adore. I wanted to own all of it, from the king's mink coat to satiny heirloom roses decorating public gardens, happy with the perfume crushed on my fingertips. Once in a while, I told someone I was lonely so I could practice dying. and in the moment those lips touched my cheek, I felt like the earth kissed by a homesick traveler, splendid in my borrowed costume of dirt and air.
Nice.
Funnily enough, the tune is called Old Lady Be Good. Seems right.
I'm sorry, I just can't.
That's no problem.
You're just drawn that way.
So maybe there's a way for you guys to talk a little bit about creative process. And I don't have any kind of pithy question to ask, but we talked about collaboration briefly, but yeah.
I'd like to know some poets you read, you know, that you feel have informed your work in some sense.
Yeah. Well, it's a huge, it's a big list, right?
That's true.
One of the poets who's been extremely important to me is Emily Dickinson, because she's so interested in seeing the small things containing the big things, yes, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So she's been huge for me. Mm-hmm. And I travel along like a little dog after W.S. Merwin. Uh-huh. Gary?
Well, definitely Dickinson. We were just remarking at our house that we got about 7 months to go till 10 years ago we met. Didn't get married 10 years ago, but met in Emily Dickinson class.
Oh, really?
yes.
Ignored each other.
Very fortuitous. Not for very long.
No. I was bad.
So we definitely share that, and I think I appreciate this about Dickinson, and I think, but also the intricacy. The exactness and yet how it shifts. Mm-hmm. John Berryman's always been just very
bad.
Important for me.
Been bad too.
I have to stay away
from
him.
Very, very bad.
Yes. I have to stay away from him
Gary,
as often.
I was just thinking, I just was reading this morning about somebody saying that Dickinson, though she got so much of her creative spirit from that solitary impulse, that she often also always imaginatively passionately wrote to another, she'd just pick somebody. So she was bad too.
She was very bad. Yeah. She's very bad.
I think her rep as being like a goody two shoes is really
Oh no, absolutely.
Yeah.
Sorry, keep going.
She's a rebel. And then I don't know. I go by Keats is always important. My Milton. I'm crazy about both the sonnets, Milton sonnets, mm-hmm. and Paradise Lost. And
I think you're the first poet we've had on the show who's ever mentioned Milton.
Yeah. I was going to say,
but he's fabulous.
You mean,
amazing.
This is where I go, because I mean, for me, it's the charge of a lot of charge of syntax. So you know, it's also somebody who can just build sentences that roll down line after line after structures. Line. Yeah. Those kinds of structures are fantastic for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool.
Process? I don't know. I mean, more and more I've been trying to take the medicine that I give my students, which is just to write. and I think that the more you write, and certainly the more you teach writing, the more self-conscious you get. And again, because I'm so in love with the sentence, there's a way in which if the sentence doesn't form, I want to not go forward. But I've just been, you know, that stalls me too much. So I've been writing some terrible sentences lately, and then going back and like, and then working with the parts, but just like letting the sentences be like awful, right off the bat. Yeah.
What makes an awful sentence?
For me, a flat one. For me, you know,
low energy,
or the, you know, not to defame the simple declarative sentence, who does a lot of work, but the workhorse sentence, it seems only to convey information that doesn't have any sense of rhythm or snap to it. I think that's what makes an awful sentence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or flabby, you know.
It's flabby.
Yeah, extra words, extra clauses.
Yeah, it's just trying. Yeah, it's doing some work, you know. Sometimes they have to do that. You know, I've learned that you have to have some sentences like that just kind of like, you know, get a little bit of work done so that the other ones can be a little more like, you know, high flying and acrobatic.
Sentence.
Yes, they're Marxist sentences. Yes, they're just work a day. Yeah.
Yeah, there's the cinder block, right, under all of the beautiful woodwork.
Yeah.
It rained.
Yeah,
yes,
exactly.
Which then again...
It's a great sentence.
It's fantastic.
Especially if it comes after some other, you know, pyrotechnics. Yeah. So actually, that's the thing I'm learning, is that it doesn't all have to be pyrotechnics. I think that's the way I would have a tendency to go. And it rained following, you know, a whole series of more complicated, complex...
Right, rhythmically, music. That can be a real nice...
Just like, wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, there it goes.
Yeah. I would have to say that in terms of process, I can't write unless I'm reading. Mm-hmm. So, and then I find myself writing poems that are similar to what I'm reading.
Some sense, right?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Like the self-portrait poem that I read at the top of the show was directly influenced by Charles Wright, who has written a number of those kinds of self-portraits. And so borrowed, like many poets do.
Oh, no, his, really?
Yeah, no, I didn't borrow it. Sorry. Borrowing is for amateurs.
That's right.
I stole
it. Right.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. You know, I stole the form, and it's a beautiful way to work, I think, and really, for me, very productive. So, you know, like many people, I can't write anything if I'm not reading something fabulous. Right. And then there is always the problem of reading somebody like Celan, whom I love, and then becoming completely taken over by him and writing only like him and being in prison. So there, I guess reading isn't a complete balm, but it's a good start.
Yeah, yeah. Do you read Celan in translation?
Da. Oh, wait, no, that's Russian. Yeah, yeah, obviously. Yeah. No, sorry, I read it in Russian translation.
I thought you said, I thought you said duh. Like, New Hampshire translation.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Salon's really easy. Duh.
Duh. So, Gary, you got a poem all lined up. You're thinking, you know.
I got a poem.
Let's hear it.
Yeah, it's called Havana Metaphysic. A woman cranes her neck to see where a line of people leads. Over the crowd into a bare, dark shop, its windows are reflecting the sea. If I said she has a hunger for things, think of clementines, petite negligee and pedophore, patent heels, diamonds in the shape of a watch, Chanel's number 15, 9, and 22, gold, hardwood, cashmere, Le Grand Dame, a daybed, Meyer lemons in a bowl resting on a glass tabletop. If not these, then what can pleasure be? The queue parts and the doorway crumbles into the street, another abandoned storefront. No, she replies, our tastes are much more exquisite. Milk, fabric, fuses, aspirin, soap, in the open water, a strong stroke.
Mm. Mm. Great sounds. Mm-hmm. I want to read a poem in response to that, or just in kind. And this is a poem by Ross Gay, who's going to be coming to town soon. We've talked about him already briefly last week, and we can mention this.
Yeah.
It's going to be a joint reading with Patrick Rizal. But this is a poem called Two Bikers Embrace on Broad Street. Maybe the sounds of your poem kind of remind me of this one. But maybe, since you're something like me, you too would have nearly driven into oncoming traffic for gawking at the clutch between the two men on Broad Street in front of the hospital, which would not stop, each man's face so deeply buried in the other's neck, these men, not my guests to be messed with, squeezing through that first porous layer of the body into the heat beneath. Maybe you too would have nearly driven over three pedestrians as your head swiveled to lock on their lock, their burly fingers squeezing the air from the angels on the backs of their denim jackets, which reminds you the million and one secrets exchanged in nearly the last clasp between your father and his brother, during which the hospital's clatter and rattle somehow fell silent in deference to the untranslatable song between them. And just as that clasp endured through what felt like the gradual lengthening of shadows and the emergence of once cocooned things, and continues to this day, so, too, did I float, unaware of the 3,000-pound machine in my hands drifting through a stoplight while I gawked at their ceaseless cleave going deeper and deeper still, so that Broad Street from Fairmont to the Parkway reeked of the honey-scented wind pushed from the hummingbirds now hovering above these two men, sweetening somehow the air, until nectar, yes, nectar, gathered at the corners of my mouth like sun-colored spittle, the steel vehicle now a last memory, while I joined the fire-breasted birds and listening to the air exchanged between these two men, who are themselves listening forever to the muscled contours of the other's neck, all of us still and listening as if we had nothing to blow up, as if we had nothing to kill.
That's fantastic.
Wow.
It's that long syntax you were talking about.
Just as, so. Mm-hmm.
But really, yeah. it rolls out, comes back in, rolls out, comes back in. Yeah. That's Ross Gay from a book called Against Which, and you're listening to Wordplay. Today, we have a great tag team, two tag teams.
It's like a cage match.
Yeah. Uh-oh. Gary Hawkins and Landon Godfrey. I'm not sure which one I'd want to fight. And Jeff Davis, I'm Sebastian Matthews.
We'd
and this is
straws.
WPVM, the progressive voice of the mountains.
3.5.
Yes. Yeah, I'm not going to get that one wrong. I don't know. We're winging it right now, and
read a poem.
How about another poem?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting.
Your turn.
We're talking about the sort of strange synchronicity on our photo blog, and so apparently there's a strange synchronicity in the poems that we're thinking about reading today, because I have a poem called Chanel Number 5. It's all about being bad. And so it's funny that you would mention all of the numbers of Chanel, well, Gary.
You got to have them all.
Yeah, I have only one, but it encompasses them all because it's the Chanel. Here's Chanel Number 5. The naked, starved scent of night. Drunken body of avarice. Mistress of empty gold leaf frames and spilled champagne. Garter belt holding up ripped stockings. Soon the skirt will be lifted. A palace ruined by fire. A fire ruined by ash. The scent before memory lies. The scent of fur and rhinestones. Tinfoil stars taped to a mirror. And cigarettes extinguished on a half-eaten plate of eggs. The scent of sagging flesh. The scent with its hand in your pocket. The scent your mother warned you about. The bitter scent. The slut. All the other girls loathe, the heartbroken.
WPVM has a new programming guide. There have been many changes made to the broadcast schedules. Some shows have been extended, some have been moved, some have been canceled. Many new programs have been added to the WPVM winter lineup. Shift in Action, Sprouts, and Media Geek are among the new nationally syndicated programs that WPVM now offers. Ooze Out, Your Mom's Idea, Off the Record, and Veterans Voices are just a few of the new locally produced programs airing on the Progressive Voice of the Mountains. Now hosting over 35 live, locally produced shows each week. We hope you are as excited about the new schedule as we are. Visit the schedule page on our website, www.wpvm.org. Check it out. And if you would like to keep a copy at your desk or on your fridge, a full-page printable version of the schedule is available for you to download. As always, we value your feedback. Please let us know what you think. Send comments to feedback@wpvm.org. WPVM is a broadcast service of the Mountain Area Information Network. Welcome back, guys. This is a fun show, free-flowing.
You know, one of the programming changes is that Wordplay now has gone to an hour, obviously, as we're already approaching the end of our old show, we would be. And now is at 2 o'clock rather than 4 o'clock on Sunday, for those of you who hadn't noticed yet. So,
I was wondering if you had kind of forgotten, and that's why you showed up.
Yeah, actually. I haven't quite figured it out yet.
I thought we could start this This is Joni Mitchell, by the way, off her new album. It's beautiful stuff. A great, angry, sad album. I thought I could start with asking you guys a question. I've been working this morning on old interviews, transcribing them from my father, the poet William Matthews, from the 70s and from the 90s. And I've been typing them up from old transcript sheets and type sheets. And one of the interviewer, Rachel Levine, asked him, what do you think is the role of poets and poetry in the U.S. or in the world? And he has an answer, and I'll give you some of it, and then maybe I can ask you guys what you might think. So I was just kind of typing this up, thinking, hey, I can ask these guys this. So he says, poetry keeps the unofficial history of what it was like to be human in a particular period of time. It takes our emotional lives seriously. Official history, who made war on whom, who signed what treaties, etc., is so large, even grandiose, in its perspective that it can barely notice individuals, and that category includes us all. I think another function of poets is to keep the language clean and to get off it as much of the dirt that advertising and contract writing and other coercive forms form. This is a hard sentence. And other coercive forms form of language promote. Some dirt is good for language, though. An absolutely clean and antiseptic language would be a dull one. Too much dirt and you can't see the mushroom. And so some proper proportion between the two is sought by poetry. I like that line. Too much dirt and you can't see the mushroom. He goes on, but I'm curious what you guys think. And he says basically it's hard to say. Some people think that poets need to be like political or stand for a certain thing, and he wonders if that's not as much of a cage as a necessity. But I'm curious what you guys think. It's a big question.
Yeah, it's huge. It's huge. At the beginning of what you were reading from your father, I was thinking of Brodsky's notion that that's where the news is. That's where the stuff is. Yeah. And I have a sense that, at least for me, the work that I'm interested in and the work that I'm in reading and doing is the work that praises things, like the Robert Haas notion of praise, and many people's notion of praise.
Rilke's notion of praise.
Or Rilke's notion, or the notion out of Ecclesiastes. Right. And that I think that that's a political gesture to affirm that we're here and that there are things that the little things like the Wilbur poem about the laundry, you know, that there's this stuff for us to be with that can remind us that we're alive.
Well, yeah, I love that notion. Actually, when I was on here last time, I was talking about Psalms and so thinking about praise in that way. When I would listen to your father's answer, the thing about the keeping language clean, I would be contrary because I don't think there is such thing as clean language. And if anything, I think poets are there to muck it up as much as possible. Although I take the point of, but I generally don't
play with the mucket anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. I basically don't buy into arguments that things, other sorts of language are, sort of corrupt and they're sort of pristine notion and certainly not a pristine area for poetry. I mean, I think it's, I do think it's an activity. I think it's a activity that is responding to the moment in that way. So it might in fact be responding to or trying to correct things that you have take issue with. It's sort of part of that whole dialogue or discourse. So anyway, I'm back to the bigger question of what the poet does. I'm thinking more and more about the activity of it or the practice of it. So I don't know where that leaves the person who's not the non-poets, but thinking about what poets do is they engage in this activity which is highly aware of language and highly aware of what's going on and are engaged in making claims, even if it's claims of the everyday, which does seem extremely important to me. I don't know. I've been processing this with the recent news, sort of dire news about the downfall of reading in America. And so the other side of that is, is writing. Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the last things that in this interview, of the question is he talks about that people say poetry is undervalued, and I think that maybe that goes along with reading. And I think maybe it is. And he says, but be careful because when it's overvalued, like the example given is the Iron Curtain years.
Yeah,
it's overvalued. You can get yourself killed.
Yeah.
And that it's so weird. And of course, most of the poets who were in that place flaunted it or took it and risked it with all their heart because they were fighting for what they believed in their words. But that sense of, you know, it may be an okay, it may be not perfect to have things undervalued or to have a reading not be as appreciated, but at the same time, then it becomes the falls on us to even work harder, maybe. I don't know.
The subversive quality of poetry still attracts me, you know. I mean, I like the fact that I don't know, that not everyone's a poet, and that you sort of, if you meet the little crew of them in a small room and you know in Asheville, you feel like you're sort of, you know, part of a small cadre of
dorks.
Folks. Yeah, dorks. exactly. Yeah. You can spot, you know. Yeah. It's a little different than like the bald guys when we see each other. Yeah. We have a little sort of moment, we nod, you know. Yeah. You can't spot the poets quite as easily, but you know,
they're there.
Sort of, yeah. Yeah, so I'm with you about that notion that it's good to be on the fringe, and not, and if that means undervalued, then
right.
That's super.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, maybe we've talked past the weather here. Maybe poems should stand up and sing a little bit. I was once accused on a panel of poets of talking about environmentalism for being preachers, and I was like, no, I'm a singer. You know.
That's good.
Yeah, and I feel like I've been hearing your guys' songs. I'd like to hear some more.
Yes, well, I have a poem that I would love to read called There Are Thousands of Stones in the Sky. And here it is. There are thousands of stones in the sky. I unlatch the bedroom armoire, and stones spill out, clattering like gossips, arguing like pundits. Stones mumble as I fluff the pillows on the bed. The windows and light bulbs are stones. I walk to the kitchen where stones stock the cupboards, pantry, and icebox. I open a can of stones for lunch and at tea time pour stones into a porcelain cup. The newspaper, columns of stones. And when I knit a scarf, stones are knitted and purled into an unending chain like a train of ashes rushing through a moonlit field. And the rivers are filled with stones. When I put on my coat, there are thousands of stones in the pockets.
So the other thing that's going on in terms of process here, Jeff, is that I get to hear poems I've maybe never heard before.
I've been watching you guys kind
that's
of
good.
Respond.
Yeah, that's good.
I'm like, hey, damn. Hey, where'd that one come from?
The secret work.
Yeah. I gotta start mucking around in your desk drawer a little bit more when you're gone.
Or poking around your computer or whatever.
It's gotta be there somewhere.
That's where they all are
what's
nowadays.
What's your password?
It's the old-fashioned underwear drawer. I'm sorry.
That's probably where she keeps them. Yeah.
That's what bad girls do, I think. Yeah,
it is.
Yeah. That's right.
I can hear you all.
Oh, really?
Oh!
Shh.
Very nice.
I love song. I mean, because this is, you know, I do think that for all the talk of the sentence, part of my attraction to poetry is the ability to say things that you can't say over coffee unless you're with the dorks and you know. So anyway, actually this poem is called Holding Onto Firmaments, and I'll just let it speak for itself. He is in the open, laying something softer down. Leaves as tokens weigh the ground, and twigs as sextants pull the low sun. Overhead, she trails a canopy of net. At the fringes line the eyes of dumb beasts. He is in the open, laying something softer down. Overhead, she trails a canopy of net. The expanse held back then trickles in. Thicker than the dark, the stars converge. Overhead, she trails a canopy of net. He is in the open, laying something softer down. Rocks in tides lift beneath the turf. Overhead, she trails a canopy of net. A tail of galaxies pulls her in. His head, as feathers, weighs his hands. He is in the open, laying something softer down.
Nice to hear those two together. Mm-hmm. Yeah, really nice.
Mm-hmm.
Can we try something here? We talk about music. We often play a lot of music on the show, and we ask people to bring in music, and you guys were game and brought a bunch in. I've been playing some tunes that I had brought in. I thought I'd play one of the tunes, Blue Monk by Monk, that you brought in, Landon, and maybe ask you guys to pick something to read, and if you want to read on top of it, I'll just accommodate that. Or if you I don't see either of you doing that, I'll bring it down. But kind of try to each pick a poem, having listened to the music, and see who starts, and see, and we'll just read two poems.
Okay. Talk.
Give it a try.
Obad is Brassai. Lamps moon a path, and no one walks. Cranes on the quay have ceased and sleep. Into the grays above, sky opposes, where buttress and cathedral seem to lift, to hold like scaffold the tiny steeple point on which the stars pivot. Midnight saturations, bodies erased at the waist. Lovers left on the Grand Boulevard huddle against an illuminated shop, black mannequins admiring nakedness, corsets and displays of minor lace. Later, in the doorway, she clings to the knob and he presses her to a kiss. Mine is the air that takes no shadows, sorrow posed beneath the bedroom's dark sky top. One mirror on the bureau has taken you in. Yours is the poise of a head bowed, with no face and with no sound, before down a shaft the rain of morning light pours and buries you in place, burns you to the page. It is too early, I am not yet weary. Unturning, you pull your stockings up. Rarely can I frame what I want. Twice I have told you I made the world, twice you have told me you own the night.
Compositions in Gray and Gray. 1. Ice on the sidewalk from a snowfall 5 days ago. The dead drink black scotch in front of a heatless fire. Downtown tavern filled with drunks who don't open their mail. Televisions around the city whinge. Even the dogs have asthma. Last night I dreamt a limerick about a guy named Darius, my louvered eyelids rhyming, and his amorous position, which were, unfortunately, various. I don't remember the rest, except someone was furious. There is no cure, but once we ate lemon icebox pie in the afternoon, and I can say we were happy. 2. Some of the dead shimmer in their silver lamé gowns and silver lipstick and silver blunt-cut wigs, twirling like wind chimes in a storm. And the others glisten in their silver lamé tuxedos and silver carnation boutonnieres and silver bowling shoes, spinning like water rushing down a drain. A mirrored ball revolving, forever memorializing the moon.
Nice. What was that poem called?
That's called Compositions in Gray and Gray.
Oh, awesome. And Gary, what was your poem called?
It's called Obad es Brassai.
Awesome. Well, we listened to your poem with the monk, and then you also brought one of my all-time favorite tunes, this incredibly beautiful, dorky La Dolce Vita music from Nino Rota, which is just awesome. It's just like...
So fantastic.
I just picture that beautiful Umbrian girl and, you know, Marcello, like hungover and trying to write in this shaded, you know, cafe, and getting the phone call from his girlfriend and
perhaps in a silver lamé tuxedo.
I think he was wearing a black suit, but it was he was smoking, and
but on the inside.
But on the inside, it was a silver lamé.
And he noticed the girl, and the writing did not happen. And anyway,
you're gonna have that.
Well, thank you guys for helping me play out that idea, that fantasy of it doesn't always work, and you guys were game. But it's I do love hearing poetry and music kind of bumping up next to each other.
Yeah, that was nice.
Yeah.
How about a poem from you?
I saw that you brought this book.
I brought We Generous. Yeah. I chose a couple of poems for you. But of course, you know, you're welcome to read whatever you like.
Let's make him read what you want to do. I think that's the way to go.
Well, I think what would be beautiful right now is to hear like a girl saying yes. I think it's this is the right moment for that.
Okay.
You've seen the girl at the cafe.
You have your tuxedo on.
I'm at WPVM, I think.
Yes.
I haven't moved forward or backward. Vic Spiderbeck is a great early jazz player of the cornet. And Louis, of course, is Louis Armstrong. Like a girl saying yes. Like a girl saying yes, is the way Condon put it, hearing Bix's cornet for the first time, a mellow tone, lofted gently from the bell of the horn, like a girl saying yes. Or as Louis said, followed no doubt by his cackle laugh. I'm telling you, those pretty notes went right through me.
Fantastic. Yeah. Thank you.
Yes.
And that's definitely Louis talking. That's just I stole that too.
Yeah. Good theft.
Yeah. Why not? Well, thank you guys. A couple more poems. We've got time. I love this hour format, Jeff. This is awesome. We're listening to Tommy Flanagan, who's was once called the Mozart of the jazz piano. Beautiful. Playing Ella Fitzgerald's standards. Jeff, did you bring anything, by the way?
No, actually not.
Okay, just checking.
Yeah.
How about...
You got something over there?
I do. How about... interview. Antique iron bed. Why don't we call it music for discretion's sake? They move, and then I move. Yes, same with the moaning. Flesh, metal, my theory, we're like each other. Just because I'm cold doesn't mean I can't feel. And when I'm empty, I'm waiting.
Here's another self-portrait. This one, self-portrait at the end of a rope. Again, I wake up early and already hungry. I desire coffee more than sex. But morning is no time for gluttony. Rather, silence, a bowl of oatmeal, the austerity of mourning doves along a fence, and I leave my wife for an hour of sleep to follow the wants of the dogs. Surprise of birds, the lab kicks up in the yard already filling with summer heat. Where overnight fans of basil have replaced those we ate. I do not stop to water them. I leave our dinner plates out on the deck, remnants of abundance on which my poverties sift like daylight through our pecan trees. Already the shaking dogs snout the gate, and a nesting cardinal shouts her protests. But now, out front, in the cloud this morning, still free of failures, I am already fleeing home. As every day around the neighborhood I am taken, pulled after cats, and torn under bushes. I pull them away from storm sewers and from the pit bulls chained to stakes, and instead find backyard gardens along the way, and account all their grand successes. The tomatoes we cannot get to take, their better decks whose handy work I wish to match, on which rest more resplendent chaises, more gorgeous pets. So when a man steps out onto his porch with his cup of coffee, I speak my first words of the morning, eclipsed Texas generosity. Good morning. I am not dead, though death for the dogs and me is still a near and wild odor, perhaps under his pile of leaves. I am not dead, though I walk along his fence now at the slower pace that the dog that spent dogs take. The man does not speak, nor nod, nor raise his cup, nor, except with his eyes, sextants down his property line, give any sign that he is alive, give any sign that I have arrived or left. What I lack, he does not want. What I have, he does not wish. At home, I free the dogs into the yard and slide back into the luxury of our big bed.
Have you heard that one before?
You know, I know I have, but I feel like I've never heard it in my life.
It's very old. It's been sitting around since Houston.
Yeah, I recognize the pecan trees.
Yeah.
It's a nice, I like that. It's a good walking poem. I mean, it's so much more than that, but the vehicle of it is that walk.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And well, the word sextant twice in one day.
And sex and coffee.
Sex and coffee.
Oh, and sex and coffee. And
yeah. Sextants.
Yeah. And that you prefer coffee is, yeah. And that you call, you know, this a cage match. Is this all evidence of a marriage?
Yeah. Perhaps in the Houston period.
That's right.
Well, it was nice having you on the show. Okay.
This is history. This is not current.
You
events.
Have been listening to Wordplay.
We'll have to bring a counselor in the next time we have
No fighting, no biting. Okay, Landon, you have a 1 minute rebuttal.
All right. I'll speak my rebuttal in the voice of Marilyn Monroe.
Oh, good.
Yeah. This is called Second Skin Rhinestone Spangled Nude Soufflé Chiffon Gown. Tonight I will be sewn into it. Tonight, Kenneth will sweep my white blonde bouffant into a side flip. Tonight, I will clutch at my milky mink wrap like a baby kangaroo climbing pouchward. Tonight, I will flirt, but I will not make jokes like now Napoleon knows what Bonaparte really means, or pun taupe and topus, or try to rhyme them with top hat, because I believe no one can. Tonight, a million flashbulbs will Morse code my one human wish. Tonight, this gown will draw fingertips towards my body like a starving galaxy devouring dark matter. The fingers of the men. The men. Tonight, I will whisper, je ne comprends pas, rien, sugar pie. And my left cheek mole will answer, we're almost there.
Nice.
Very nice.
Thank you. I inadvertently added a little pa in there. For all the French speakers in the audience, I realize my error.
Yeah. It's just so fun to pop the peas, you know? Now, if there's ever a chance, a reason to hear a title of a poem again, now is the time.
Yeah.
What's the title again?
This is called Second Skin Rhinestone Spangled Nude Soufflé Chiffon Gown. And I think we can all picture Marilyn in that particular gown.
It's not that hard.
Into which she was sewn and in which she could not sit down.
Really?
Really. Mm-hmm.
Soufflé.
Yeah.
Soufflé. Sextant.
Yes.
Sonorous. Dorks.
Sibilant dorks, though.
Yes,
totally.
The sibilant dorks of language. We could start a club.
Yeah. But we wouldn't. I wouldn't join it. Yeah. See, that's the other thing about poets is that they try to do clubs and groups and schools, right. And then people start to infight, and then it's gone. It's over.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
The great poetry wars.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, we have time for some more poetry, and I think we should hear a couple more. This is wonderful back and forth. We should only invite couples or partners.
or just assign everyone to find a partner outside before they
pick your buddy.
Come in.
Here's some wordplay cage match.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. Slam, knockdown. What was the, oh God, what was the, my son, Avery, was running around on his little, sliding around on his skateboard scooter today. He calls it a skateboard scooter. And he was saying, "Street rat, take that."
Wow.
Yeah. Street rat, take that. But that was pretty good.
That is good.
Double spondy.
It's hard to get those.
Yeah. Okay, I'm just going to chatter for a while. You got some?
Yeah.
First up.
An undersea ballad. I speak of love that coves the mind, looking out with yellow eyes. Outside float flourishes, suns and sharks. My lowing love repools the dark. I never dreamed the sea so harsh, my coral heart so sharp. I have become a sound in tide. From the seafloor, my longings disperse and rise.
Nice. Now that I've heard you read a couple times in the last, you know, month or two, I really love the way you, I mean, I love the sounds of your poems, but you seem to, you do a kind of, like, what was the two L's and the two, you doubled two sounds back and forth. What's the name for it?
Alliteration?
Is it alliteration when it's just, like, coupling two of the same sounds together? Or same, like, the L's?
Assonance.
Yeah.
Assonance is if it's vowels, and alliteration if it's consonants.
I didn't know if it had to be, like, three or more.
No, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, well, you know, yeah. Our students are listening thinking they're teaching
it. Oh, man. Is there a test?
Yeah.
Anyway. You know, Einstein said it. You don't have to memorize it if you can look it up.
Yeah.
This is pre-Google, too.
That's right. Exactly.
Einstein would love Google.
So anyway, I like what you do, man.
Yeah. Well, yeah. They sort of, that's how they generate themselves. Something gets started and then the poems listen to each other. It's like accretion. So they start at the top line and then they, if I'm lucky, you know, I'll get another line and then I'll accrete another line. Mm-hmm.
Do you have a muse?
Do you have a muse? Mm-hmm. There she is.
Okay. You married your muse?
Yes.
Zunes.
Yeah.
How do you spell that word?
Z-O-U-N-D-S. Yes. Zunes.
Oh, then I have to, I have to read this poem then.
We have to ask Landon what your muse.
Yeah.
Oh, Landon, I suppose the funniest answer would be, you know, myself, but that's terrible and it's not true. Yeah. And, you know, I can't answer the question because I have a philosophical problem with the muse.
The
I'm always extremely angry at her and she's very, you know, mean to me.
Is it her for you?
Well, you know, I think that sort of gendered embodiment does not offend. She could be a she, absolutely.
Okay.
But I'm the kind of writer who has to go to the desk and invite her. I can't wait for her. So I can't picture her.
You don't get whole lines or multiple lines occurring as you're driving the car, you know, to the superstore, the supermarket.
No, I don't. I'm a peasant. I don't.
So you go and sit at the desk and invite the muse.
I do. Yeah. I have to do that. Uh-huh.
It's actually sort of more perverse, right? Because then the dreams deliver you a limerick.
I know. I'm tortured.
With Darius.
It's true. Oh, I have to stop myself all the time from rhyming. It's a pleasure that I allow myself occasionally in poems, but I do have to stop myself from writing that kind of thing because I know it's not, you know, it's just not very attractive to others.
Well, just the real dorks like the Heather McHughes and, you know, the Marianne Moores of the world, like, you know, be happy to let you.
Should I read you a rhyming?
Oh, yes. Sure. Yes.
Okay, just talk amongst yourselves because I don't know exactly where it is, but it's right here.
Well, I was thinking, you said superstore by mistake. I was thinking, you know, those big, like, Walmart stores, if there was, like, kind of a Christian bookstore, it would be called Jesus Christ Superstore. Do you think that'd be good?
I think you might have something there.
Yes. And have you copyrighted the concept yet?
No, I did a little Bad New York. I have a thing I do called Bad New Yorker cartoons where I try to draw it, and then by the time I'm done,
it's so bad.
It just looks so bad and so stupid that I've killed it. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Somebody will probably build one.
Oh no!
Well, then there's the graffiti I saw in a bar in Eugene, Oregon that said "No left turn, unstoned."
That's nice.
Yeah, I challenge you all to come up with a very common saying like that, like no,
just turn it around.
Yeah, and then I call it scrambles and scramble it, but don't change a single syllable. Mm-hmm. You can break it apart any way you want, but you have to use the exact same amount. Try it; they're really fun.
It's terrific.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay, I feel space.
Yeah,
there you go.
Okay, here we go. Vestis culpa. They left the garden without God's mercy. Now Adam and Eve live in New Jersey. He's a haberdasher, she's a seamstress. Eve spends her day in a tired old print dress and a polyester slip and brassiere and pantyhose and cotton underwear and cheap ugly shoes that bimbo her feet. Adam is withering as an aesthete. He concentrates on finding the right hat to match his hanky, to match his new spats, to complement his hand-knotted silk tie and the small flecks of green in his left eye. He reads Playboy and misses the old days before clothing garnered him boundless praise and enslaved his wife in subway fashion. Staring at girls reminds him of passion. To Eve, however, that represents guilt, their guilt, not just hers, in this life they've built. Their unheeded prayers have become shallow and bitter. Their cold marriage lies fallow, covered in clothes, clothes, clothes. Buttons and elastic have made them foes. If only they could unlearn well-hemmed cuffs, French seams, scarves, expensive shoes, fur muffs, and the shopping grammar of clothes on sale. If only the touch of skin would prevail. May they abandon hope of God's blessing and know the divine love of undressing.
Awesome.
Yes.
Bimbo her
that
feet.
Rhyme, but yeah.
That's good.
Still
thank you.
Yeah. I'm trying to think.
Thank you.
It's got the rhythm and the rhyme of the Henri Balak, that child's tale of the girl who's bad and doesn't tell, who tells lies and the house goes on fire.
I don't know her.
It. Yeah. It's a great, great poem. But that's gorgeous.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That was lovely.
Thank you.
We should probably at that point stop and say thank you. And I'm going to close out when we're done with some music that you gave me from the soundtrack of
Darjeeling Limited.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll play with that. That'll be our play out. And
lovely
then
film.
Yeah. I can't wait to see it. And you guys, so good to have you. I think we're going to have you again at some point.
It's so good to be here.
An hour is not enough time.
We'll come back. Thanks a lot.
Nice
thank
poetry
you,
and nice to hear them together.
Yeah.
Thank
and
you.
Please behave, you know, try to get along a little better.
Okay. Yeah.
You've been listening to Wordplay, and Jeff, you got to help me out here because I don't want to embarrass myself one more time. You got this down.
We're produced in the studios of WPVM in downtown Nashville. And check us out on the web.
Great.
Wordplayradio.blogspot.com.
Fancy apartment off the boulevard Saint-Michel, where you keep your Rolling Stones records and a friend.
Mm-hmm.